Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in Film Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Nathan Abrams, the host of the channel. Today, we'll be talking to Joseph McBride about his new book, the Whole Dern Human Comedy, Life According to the Coen Brothers. Joseph McBride is an internationally renowned film historian, biographer and critic, who has written 22 other books, including acclaimed biographies of Frank Capra, John Ford, and Steven Spielberg. Joseph, welcome to the show.
Yeah, great to be with you, Nathan. Thanks for having me.
Oh, you're welcome. It's great, great to be chatting with you. So, Joseph, I wonder if you could begin the interview by telling us a bit about yourself.
Well, I've been writing about film since the late '60s, and I began studying Orson Welles in 1966 in college. I saw Citizen Kane when I was 19, and that set me on my course of wanting to be a film historian, film scholar, and screenwriter, etc., and I've done all three, and I've written three books on Welles, and the first book took 4 years to write and was published by the British Film Institute in the Cinema One series, and through that I got to meet Welles. He was reading the chapters I was publishing in film magazines, and he liked them, and I went to Hollywood in 1970, and I met John Ford because I was doing a book on Ford with Mike Wilmington for Cinema Two series, and As everybody knows, film knows, Ford was a notoriously tough interviewee, and I had this very bizarre interview with him. He was really uncooperative, but you know, fascinating to study him for a future biographer. I wrote a biography of him in 2001. It came out in 2001, but it took about 30 years of research off and on. He was such a difficult man to figure out. It really was helpful to spend an hour with him just studying his body language and all the behavior. And he retired in the course of the interview. He suddenly announced his retirement. And during the interview, he kept calling to his secretary and saying, has the Italian gentleman called? A gentleman from Italy, as he called. He was very anxious about this. And I didn't know what the heck was going on. And then he retired. He announced his retirement. He said, I'm a hard-nosed, hard-working ex-director, and I'm trying to retire gracefully. It was very moving. And I found out many years later in Ford's papers that he was waiting for a call from Italy to do an Italian Western that Woody Strode, his good friend and star, had tried to set up for him in Italy, and it wasn't happening. And Ford at that point realized that he was not going to make another film. And it came to a head that day. And 3 days later, I was acting in Orson Welles' The Other Side of the Wind, which is about an old director, partly modeled on John Ford and partly modeled on Ernest Hemingway. And I play a young critic historian who's following this old guy around, peppering him with kind of absurd film buff questions. And it's the last day of his life. People by now have seen The Other Side of the Wind, which took 48 years to come out. I spent 5 years acting in that film. That was my film school. And I didn't have a formal film school education. We only had three film courses, and I taught myself how to write screenplays and write books. And but I was with Welles for 5 years. He's such a great director of actors, and it was fascinating. So I've done two other books on him. And then I went to Hollywood and wrote screenplays for 18 years and decided to in 1984 to go full-time writing books, which I enjoy more. And I spent 7.5 years doing a biography of Frank Capra, which was very difficult but very satisfying. I 4 years of that were spent on a legal battle trying to get the book published. And I recently published a book about that legal battle called Frankly Unmasking Frank Capra, which is kind of a Kafkaesque saga of a nightmarish experience in the publishing industry. Capra's archivist, Janine Basinger, and my editor at Knopf, Robert Gottlieb, the famous editor, were conniving against me, trying to either stop the book or neuter the book, because it upends the Capra legend. And Capra's autobiography was almost completely false. And so I corrected all the myths, and I revealed that Capra was an informer during the blacklist period, for example, and they were trying to stop all that from coming out. So anyway, then I did a biography of Steven Spielberg, and I got my Ford book published, my Ford biography, and I keep writing film books, and I've written 2 books on the Kennedy assassination, one of which came out last December, called Political Truth, the Media and the Assassination of President Kennedy, which I'm very proud of. And I did a book on Billy Wilder. It came out around the same time. Billy Wilder, Dancing on the Edge, a big critical study from Columbia University Press. So I've been very busy, and I teach full-time at San Francisco State University as well.
Wow, that's quite a varied career. In comparison to my rather staid academic one that involves, I did appear in an episode of The Watchmen, but that's it, as an extra, the new one.
Teaching for 20 years now, full-time, and I didn't do that much. I mean, I taught a few courses in Los Angeles before I moved to the San Francisco Bay Area, but I got a job teaching at San Francisco State. And I enjoy that a lot. It's great to have contact with young people, keep on your toes. And I teach film history and screenwriting. I've been doing that full-time, and I write books on the side. It's really a nice life, actually, and I know you do the same.
Not as many books as you've done. Now, I understand if there's a Stanley Kubrick story in there. Would you like to tell us about that?
I admire you for doing Kubrick. He's always been one of my very favorite directors. And I used to think it'd be fun to write a biography of Kubrick, but I live in California and you live in you live in Wales, don't you?
I understand that there's a Stanley Kubrick story in there.
Well, I wrote a biography of Spielberg, and of course, he did AI, kind of completing the vision of Kubrick. And I have a different view of Kubrick and Spielberg from the conventional view, and I'm curious what you think. The conventional view is that Kubrick is a very cold misanthrope, and Spielberg is a very sentimental guy. And I actually think they're closer together than people realize, and I see Kubrick as a disappointed romantic, which is what I.L. Diamond called Billy Wilder. And he said Wilder worked in the tradition of Arthur Schnitzler, which Kubrick did too with Eyes Wide Shut. And disappointed romantic is a good description of Kubrick. I think he was disappointed in humanity, and he makes films showing people as very flawed as we are. And Spielberg is a more optimistic director, no doubt, but he's has a lot of dark themes in his films, a lot of obsessive themes, nightmarish themes, neurotic themes, and I think AI is a really good collaboration between them, a good marriage of the two. I went to Kubrick's memorial service at the Directors Guild, and Spielberg spoke, and that's when people didn't know until then that he was had this telephone friendship with Kubrick, and they were on the phone a lot and faxing each other. And he said that Kate Capshaw, Kubrick insisted on Steven installing a fax machine in his bedroom so that he could send him faxes at any time of the day. And Kate Capshaw finally said, "Move that fax machine out of the bedroom. I can't stand it." Anyway, but he talked about that a lot, and people were really surprised. They didn't know how close Spielberg was to Kubrick. And then AI came after that, of course, and it was a fascinating time. I actually, when people were standing in the lobby talking to Spielberg, I saw Louis Blau and James Harris standing talking to each other. And I thought, well, these are the two most important guys at this event, and nobody knows who they are, and they're standing by themselves. I'll go over and talk to them. So I had a wonderful talk with those two guys. As you know, they were absolutely crucial to Kubrick's career. And, you know, I'd like to look for the people like that who are really the key people that people may not know about.
Yeah, no, I'm not in disagreement about. I think Kubrick is incorrectly described as a cold and misanthropic director, and I actually think his films are far more hopeful. And that the if you look at the final sequences in many films, they provide images of hope, Paths of Glory, Spartacus, even Doctor Strangelove, 2001, and then his final film, Eyes Wide Shut, ends with the word, you know, with the F word, as if to say, go forth and multiply. So I think there's much more hopeful outlook to Kubrick than I think people buy into his reputation too uncritically.
Yeah, the whole thing about him being a recluse feeds into that. But I mean, he had the kind of ideal life. His house was kind of like his film studio, and he worked out of his house just like most people are doing now during the pandemic. And he was ahead of his time. I had a great experience with a Kubrick film I should mention. One of the formative experiences of my life, along with Citizen Kane and a couple of other things. But in 1964, I went to see Dr. Strangelove at our neighborhood theater in Wauwatosa, Wisconsin. It's now called the Rosebud Theater. I went with my best friend, who was a brilliant guy. He wound up being number one in his class at Harvard Law School, and he's a great lawyer, a brilliant fellow. And anyway, during the film, I thought it was a scary thriller. You know, I didn't get the humor, but my friend kept chuckling all the way through. And then he said, as we could say in those days, he said, let's sit through it again. You know, back in the day, you could sit through a film a second time. And the second time I saw it, I got the humor. It took me a while because it was a paradigm shift for a lot of us. You know, black comedy was not something we were used to in those days. And I love that film. I got it. And I came out of the theater, and I really feel I was a different human being when I came out of the theater. It had such a profound effect on me. And it was a key step in my rebellion against authority figures. I was a Catholic kid, and I wrote a memoir about my Catholic upbringing, and I had a nervous breakdown when I was in high school, and I was in a mental hospital. It was very traumatic, but it was really the best thing that ever happened to me. But I had to rebel against the church and my upbringing, and Kubrick played a role in that by teaching me to not believe in authority.
Well, this is fascinating. Rather than ask you more questions about that, what I'm going to do is use Kubrick as the segue, and a rather nice segue between our conversation now and the book that we want to talk about today, which is The Whole Dern Human Comedy, because of course Coen's quite influenced by Kubrick, right?
Yeah, they're very similar, aren't they, in many ways, and they have similar detractors who think they're misanthropes and they're chuckling over, you know, hatred of humanity or, you know, superior attitude toward mankind, etc. And the way I structure my book, I decided to take the principal objections to the Coen brothers and answer each one, which is something I learned from the Jesuits, actually. I went to a Jesuit high school, and they teach you to defend your faith by what you do is you ask the other side, okay, tell me what you think, and then you tear it apart. And they're very good at dialectics and debate, and I learned that technique. And so what you got to do is get the other side to say why they hate the Coen brothers. And Jay Hoberman proved to be a very useful foil for me because he's a critic who's a smart fellow, and he writes interesting books about films in different decades of American history and how they reflect history, etc. But he's got a tremendous hatred for Spielberg and a tremendous hatred for the Coen brothers. And he's very wrongheaded, I think. And so I used him as a foil, but other people too, you know, people claim they were anti-Semitic and a serious man. And I think, you know, I go into that in detail. And so a lot of people don't like them blending violence with comedy, which I think is one of their great strengths and one of the reasons they're so popular, because comedy and violence are very intertwined. I mean, Arthur Penn and Bonnie and Clyde showed that humor and violence are close together, and people kind of react sometimes when the first thing when I heard Kennedy was shot, I heard that from a kid in our cafeteria line, and I laughed because it just struck me as absurd, you know. But I realized that he wasn't kidding, so I spun around and ran out to a radio and listened to it. But in the Left-Handed Gun, there's a famous scene where a guy gets shot out of his boots, and there's a shot of a cowboy boot sort of wobbling in the street, and a little kid laughs, and his mother slaps him in the face. That's a great scene. And so that kind of shows you people. You know, Jean Renoir said, for example, when he rehearsed actors, he used to what he called the Italian method, which is not to let them act, just have them read the script for a while. And he said the first reaction actors give is a cliche. It's always some obvious cliche, like a mother, child dies, she would cry. But he said, I've been to many funerals where people are laughing, for example, and, you know, to get the unexpected reaction. And that's partly what Kubrick and the Coen brothers do. They get very human, contradictory, conflicting impulses in people, and they bring them out onto the screen. And it gives a real sense of life and its complexity, which a lot of filmmakers don't even approach, I think.
Yeah, there's one thing that you said there that I really wanted to pick up on. And yeah, I mean, you attribute it to the Jesuits, but it also sounds, in a way, when you said dialectical or Socratic, it sounds Talmudic. One could describe both the Kubrick and the Coens as Talmudic filmmakers. How would you react to that?
Yeah, there's an interesting book, Stanley Kubrick is Jewish Intellectual, I think is the title, a good book. And, well, A Serious Man is the kind of classic text in that regard, because it's about their upbringing, or it's reflective of their upbringing in Minneapolis as Jewish kids in the 50s. And, I'm from the same period as the Coens. I'm a little older, but they felt very odd being Jewish. There is a Jewish community in Minneapolis, but it's mostly, you know, Scandinavian people, et cetera. And they called themselves Jews on the Plains. And that's kind of what Buster Scruggs is about to some extent. But they were outsiders, and I've always gravitated to writing about directors who see themselves as outsiders, like Frank Capra was an outsider as an immigrant to America, and Ford was a proudly Irish guy growing up at a time when people were supposed to be ashamed of their ethnic roots, and he was very proud of his. And Orson Welles is an outsider because he's a genius and an aristocrat in a popular medium, as Jean Renoir calls it. But the Coen brothers were feeling a bit alien in that environment. And Ethan wrote a good short story in his collection about a kid who was going through Hebrew school and feeling very alienated. And it's very funny and very sad and very dark and all that, which A Serious Man is. A Serious Man is really basically their version of the Book of Job, I think. I'm not the first person who said that, but people attack the film as being vicious toward humanity, because at the end of the film, you know, God sends a tornado to attack a school and kill kids. And the tornado is coming toward the son of the protagonist at the end of the film, and that's the end of the film. But nobody attacks the Book of Job for being too negative. They apply different standards to literature and to films. I think because Truffaut once told me, I knew him well in Hollywood, he said, serious filmmakers have a dilemma, because he said life leads toward dissolution and ultimately death. And if you're trying to tell the truth, that's the truth. And yet what the public wants is something optimistic. They want a happy ending. And somehow you have to navigate between those two poles. And Orson Welles said, a happy ending depends on where you stop your story, you know. And so the Coen brothers do not provide easy consolatory stories, but they're, Serious Man is a very bleak ending, but there's something kind of funny in a very dark way about that film. And also in the Book of Job, which I reread, he goes to friends for advice, and they can't really give him good advice why God would inflict such punishments on a good man, you know. It's one of the classic dilemmas of humankind. And so in the Coen brothers film, excuse me, the fellow goes to see three rabbis who he hopes to get answers from, and none of them can give him a good answer. And one guy is kind of sarcastic. He's kind of a wiseacre. He's a funny guy. And another one is a really ancient rabbi who's listening to rock music. And, the guy can't get an answer. And his colleagues are all hostile to him, and terrible things are happening to him. As an academic, I really identify with the scene where there's a Korean student who's trying to pressure him into giving him a better grade, trying to bribe him. I think he gives him $1,000 or something, and he turns it back, in outrage, and the kid's father shows up and kind of threatens him, and the father says, culture clash, And one of the sad things in the film is that he finally agrees to change the kid's grade. There's a close-up where he's taking his pen and marking the, whatever it is to a better grade. He's compromising. But then he has this really black comedy thing where his wife is cheating on him with this very smarmy guy, and the man gets killed in a car accident. And our hero has to pay for his funeral. And, it's just ridiculous, all the things that are heaped on this poor man. And I find it a very compassionate film. It's we love the central character. I think, the Coens love their characters. They've said that. They call them a confederacy of idiots. And it's kind of like John Kennedy Toole, a confederacy of dunces. They see mankind as a bunch of buffoons to some extent, and we all are. But there's a very serious tone to a lot of the films, and you look at the darker films, like No Country for Old Men, and Fargo is a very dark film. It starts out as kind of a fun, funny film, and that's the one that is the most beloved, I think, by the public, because Marge Gunderson is such a beloved character, and she's a real positive figure of humanity. Female police chief who's pregnant and waddling through the snow and having morning sickness, but she's very sharp, solving crimes and a great character. And the public just loved that character. But the film is really horrifying in a lot of ways, pushing a guy into a wood chipping machine and things like that. And this fool who thinks he can pull off this scam and get away with it just leads him into what's the line that John Goodman uses in Big Lebowski? A world of pain. He's talking about we're going to be in a world of pain. And that's kind of what happens in a lot of the Coen Brothers films. Josh Brolin stumbles upon a drug deal gone bad, and he makes a big mistake. He picks up the suitcase full of money. Number one rule, if you stumble upon a drug deal gone bad, turn around, get the hell out of there, and don't pick up the suitcase. Look what happens, I see them as the heirs to Billy Wilder. Billy Wilder is one of my favorite directors, and I wrote a book on him recently, the Billy Wilder Dancing on the Edge. And I've been studying him for more than 50 years. But the Coens, to me, are the contemporary equivalents of Billy Wilder in many ways. And a lot of Wilder films are about scams or masquerades and people trying to pull off a caper of some kind or some kind of... they think they're very clever, and they're really not, and blows up in their faces, and that's kind of the plot of a lot of Coen Brothers films.
I'm glad that you mentioned the wood chipper, because when you talked about comedy, my brother and I just make of this what you will, send each other pictures of wood chippers because of that film. And the picture in your book, I took a picture of and straight away sent it to him. No caption needed. That's because we used to live together.
You don't have one in your backyard, do you?
Well, I did have one in my backyard, so of course I did take a picture of it. I suppose this is another podcast. You can psychoanalyze my brother's relationship with my brother as represented by the wood chipper. So let's go back to the beginning. I mean, you talked about how you took that Jesuit approach to sort of rejecting the criticisms. What motivated you to write the book? How did you come to write it?
Well, I was thinking about them for a long time because they are my favorite contemporary filmmakers, along with Spielberg. I love Spielberg, Nigel Morris, a British scholar, called me the godfather of Spielberg studies, and I daringly wrote a positive biography of him back in the 90s when everybody else was attacking him. Although actually coincided with Schindler's List coming out, and he got a lot of praise from people who previously dumped on him. But I've always loved the Coen brothers. And the first time I saw theirs was Fargo, and I had a kind of mixed view because I'm from Wisconsin, which is adjacent to Minnesota. And people in Wisconsin, people call that flyover country in America. In other words, the middle of part of America is considered culturally not respectable compared to the coasts. California and New York are the intellectual or creative havens. And they see people in middle America as a bunch of dolts, you know, and they make fun of our accents and everything. And in Fargo, I was kind of offended the first time I saw it because the Coen brothers are kind of making fun of the broad accents of the people. Oh, yeah, you know, groceries, and oh, yeah, well, good to see you, you know. And I thought, geez, you know, I mean, I had a lot of that kind of stuff heaped on me over the years. But then I went home a few months later and back to Wisconsin, and all my relatives were raving about Fargo. And they all talk like that. They have that kind of accent. It's a Midwestern accent of some kind. I don't know where it comes from. Scandinavian or German or something, but and I said, well, didn't you feel that they were making fun of you? And they said, oh, no, we just felt great that people like us are on the screen, you know. And I mean, Marge is an adorable character, everybody loves her, it's hard not to like her. But Jerry Lundegaard, the lead guy, is a real fool, and he has that kind of accent. But they just thought, you know, all this stuff is really funny and cute, and so I kind of thought, well, hey, you know, just telling the truth about the way people are. And kind of relaxed on that front. So that was my first kind of mixed take. I think maybe the Coen brothers take a bit of getting used to because they make films that are, they mix genres. And Truffaut mentioned that in the Hitchcock interview book. He said Americans are uncomfortable with the mixture of genres. And I looked up the review in the New York Times of Shoot the Piano Player, and Bosley Crowther, who was infamous as being like the stupidest film critic of all time, or not quite, but I mean, he was right up there. He said this film is ridiculous because it's a comedy, and then somebody gets shot and somebody gets killed, and then Truffaut wants us to laugh, and then he has people singing songs, and you know, what is he doing here, you know? And I think that's what Truffaut was reacting against, you know, the people in America just didn't get Shoot the Piano Player. And that's very much like a Coen Brothers film. You know, like you have funny stuff going on. Burn After Reading is an underrated film. I think that's a good satire of politics. It's about the CIA and a bunch of idiots, lovable idiots, the Coen Brothers characters, Frances McDormand and Brad Pitt. And they find the confessions of a CIA guy who was expelled for drunkenness, John Malkovich, and they try to sell it to the Russians, and the Russians kind of wonder, why are these idiots trying to sell us CIA secrets? You know, what's going on? They just want some money so that Francis can get a plastic surgery operation. You know, and the Russians think these people are morons, which they are. But the Coen brothers love those kind of characters because it's kind of humanity in the raw. But the mixture of comedy and violence disconcerts people. But The Big Lebowski is a film everybody loves, of course, and especially young people. It became a real cult film with young people. Some of the Coen brothers films didn't do terribly well commercially when they first came out. They got picked up, you know, in home video. People started watching them. And Big Lebowski is terrific. But again, there's a mixture of violence and comedy. And the mixture of tone is something Billy Wilder does. And it's one reason I like him a lot, like in The Apartment. There's some really cruel behavior, terrible, crass, corrupt behavior, and some very tender romanticism and some very sweet comedy in that film. And it's all mixed up like in real life, you know? So they're the heirs of Billy Wilder. They're the sons of Billy Wilder is the way I like to put it.
I'm glad you mentioned The Big Lebowski. I don't know if I count as a young person, but that's probably my favorite. And I don't know, my cushions have fallen down, but I have Big Lebowski cushions behind me of each of the main characters.
Yeah, I see John Goodman over there.
Yeah, I'll have to prop them up so you can see. Useless on a podcast.
And, you know, one thing I found they don't like to give interviews very much because, one reason, there are a couple of reasons people, one reason I write books about filmmakers is if they're misunderstood or some injustice is being done to them. Like when I wrote two books on John Ford, both times he was critically disregarded, and I wanted to help bring him back to his deserved stature. And the Coens often got kind of stupid reviews. I felt people insulting them and everything, and I think people didn't understand them. And so that's why I, dig into these filmmakers. And Spielberg is another example, somebody who was being trashed all the time by people. And Capra, on the other hand, was deceived his public and informed on his colleagues and things. So he was a case of somebody who was misunderstood in a different way. But the Coen brothers, one of the reasons they're misunderstood, that when they give interviews, they're like John Ford. They act kind of silly and sarcastic. You know, they give sarcastic answers. Joel Coen was asked what it's like to be a director. He said, well, it beats throwing trash for a living. And it reminded me of John Ford, my favorite filmmaker, and I had the experience of interviewing him, as I said. And when I interviewed Ford, I was frustrated because I kind of hoped he would open up to me and, give good answers to questions. But he would pretend not to remember films like What's the Searchers, What's Fort Apache. I had to remind him what they were. And obviously, he was playing a game with me, as he did with interviewers his whole life. He didn't believe in it was a self-protective device. He didn't want to share his feelings in interviews, but you can get his feelings from his films. That's where they live. And he's a very emotional filmmaker and a very, very complex. But in some ways, it hurts a filmmaker's reputation if they don't explain things to the public. And the Coen brothers have always refused to explain their films to the public. And I came to respect that in John Ford, because what John Ford was kind of saying to us is, I'm not going to tell you what to think of my films. Watch the films, make up your own mind. I respect the audience, And the Coen brothers do the same. They're very bright, intellectual guys. They could explain it, but they think that's a big joke, And they see film theory and film scholarship as kind of ridiculous in some ways, which it is. And they just make films and they let people enjoy them, but they're not about to explain it. I did notice that when you read Coen brothers' interviews, when they're in Europe, they're a little more forthright than they are in America. They think the American audience is pretty stupid, which we are. But they're actually very big in France, and I'm also fascinated by how these guys have managed to make such personal films over a long period of time in an industry which right now is not open very much to personal filmmaking. You have to be a Spielberg or Scorsese, or a few people can get away with making pet projects. But the Coen brothers have always made the kind of films they wanted to make, pretty much. And part of it is their funding comes from Europe. A lot of their funding is European. And they have a good reputation in France and other countries. And but somehow they've manipulated the studios into letting them get away with murder, whatever they want to do. And they're kind of enigmatic, mysterious characters by nature, but they're kind of taciturn too. And I've never met them. I don't know a lot about their personal lives, but I just know their films, and I find them very amusing when you listen to them talking. There's a very funny interview with them about A Serious Man on the DVD, when they talk about somebody says, will Jewish people in Minneapolis be offended by this film? And they're kind of laughing about that. And, oh, we don't mean to, make anybody feel bad about this film. they clearly don't care. And if I made a film about Catholics in Wisconsin, I would be pretty sarcastic and pretty harsh. And that's what they're entitled to do with their upbringing, is be very critical. But some critics have interpreted that as anti-Semitism, which I think is way off the mark. And so I deal with that criticism in my book, and defend them against that charge. I think they're just dealing with their heritage in a very candid way, and how it felt to them. And they actually, they're even though some people say they're nihilists, that's another charge made against them. And Kubrick is often accused of being a nihilist or something like that. And I don't think they are at all. And if you look at their films carefully, a lot of their characters have some kind of vague aspirations to higher meaning in life. They don't quite know what it is, but they're after it, you know. Like the guys in O Brother, Where Art Thou? They're kind of vaguely spiritual in some way. And the guy in Serious Man is looking for serious spiritual answers to the biggest philosophical dilemmas of humankind. And this happens throughout their work. And when you deal with a very bleak film like No Country for Old Men, the lawman in that film is a man of great dignity and integrity, Tommy Lee Jones. He's an old-fashioned cowboy kind of lawman. And what the film is really about is that a guy like that is an anachronism in modern America, because we're a land of serial killers and, you know, people shooting up schools. And he has to deal with this complete maniac who's going around killing people. And he admits that he can't understand this kind of evil. So that's a really serious philosophical riddle that they're trying to explore in the film. How do you deal with that kind of evil that's rampant in our culture? And a guy like that who has integrity and he's a very efficient lawman, he's just no match for this killer. And that theme appears in other Coen Brothers films, True Grit, somewhat like that. Other films where they have characters, or, you know, Marge in Fargo, like she's at the end of the film, she's driving the maniac to the police station in her car, and she says, "It's a beautiful day, and you know, look at it, it's wonderful. And why are you doing this? You're killing people for a few dollars? What's the point? You know, I don't get it." She just doesn't get it, but she's a good person, you know. So they're not nihilists at all. They're faced with the dilemma of what does a good person do in a naughty world, as Shakespeare called it.
Yeah, couple of things I just wanted to pick up on, because they've sort of touched on my pet interest, which is I've written about the representation of Jews in contemporary cinema, and I used the from 1990 onwards, and I used a lot of Coen films, so Bernie and his sister in Miller's Crossing, for example. There's the rabbi. I love the scenes with the rabbi on Hail Caesar. The interdisciplinary faith forum. I sit on a chaplaincy team at the university, and as a Jewish advisor, whenever I'm sitting there, I think of that sequence and what would happen if I played that rabbi. And for me, the epitome of all this is Walter, because Walter's a very interesting character in The Big Lebowski, because he's ethnically not Jewish, Polish, but religiously Jewish and highly unusual, but foul-mouthed, a Vietnam War veteran that frames his whole outset, seemingly based in part on John Milius. And he's fascinating because to me, he's the antithesis of how, you know, he's like, "I'm as Jewish as Tevye." I'll omit the swearing from this podcast, but, you know, "as Jewish as Tevye," but you couldn't get a character as far from Tevye, size and beard apart. And so the interesting thing is, you know, I know you focus a lot of attention on A Serious Man, and people talk about this as being anti-Semitic or self-hating or self-loathing, was one of the quotes you put in the book. And you're like, well, to be honest, apart from the few exceptions that you just mentioned, which Coen characters do come off well, he doesn't. It's not the Jews that come in for special treatment, really. It's the odd cop, from the way you've presented it.
There's a funny line at the very end of the credits of Serious Man that says, "No Jews were harmed in the making of this motion picture," which is their kind of joke about, you know, offending people's sensibilities, tender sensibilities. But yeah, you're right. I mean, they're kind of ruthless toward humankind in general, but they do have characters who are good people, but they're exceptions, definitely. And there are films in which there aren't any good people. I mean, they don't have to put good people into the films. Burn After Reading, I find very funny, because it's just a bunch of pathetic losers trying to outwit each other. And, you know, it's kind of The Lady Killers, I kind of like. Even that's a film that everybody is supposed to dislike. I find it a very amusing film. I don't think it's quite as good as the original British film, which is a better film. But I love Irma P. Hall, the black actress, who's just great. And Lady Killers is very innocent. She's a good person. She's a religious person. And she's beatific and she survives. Alexander McKendrick, who directed the original Ladykillers, said in a commentary that the old lady in his film actually winds up killing everybody because she's so innocent. That he found that really interesting, that all these people are, you know, think they're outwitting her, but she survives because of her beatific innocence. And that's what Irma P. Hall does. And she has a great monologue at the beginning of the film. She comes in and complains about her nephew to a cop, about his hippity-hop rap music. It's like a wonderful monologue. But she's in this house with all these criminals, and they all wind up getting killed one by one, and she survived. One thing that offended people was she winds up getting the money, the illicit money, and she doesn't quite realize, you know, what it is. And so she gives it to Bob Jones University, which is a university in the United States, which is a notoriously racist Southern institution, which, you know, doesn't for a long time they wouldn't let black people in the school, et cetera. But she's naive, and she gives it to this terrible place. And people thought that Coen Brothers had been cruel toward this wonderful lady. Well, I mean, this is a sad joke about humanity, that people are exploited. Good people are exploited. You see this all the time in political life, that hapless people in middle America and the South and in England and wherever are exploited by unscrupulous politicians and criminals, and they take advantage of their goodness and their naivete. And naivete can be a dangerous thing too. You know, one of my students pointed out in Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, one of my favorite films, Jimmy Stewart is, you know, the idealistic politician, but this student pointed out that this is a guy who comes to Washington, he knows nothing about government, and yet he's a U.S. senator. He publishes a statewide newspaper, and he doesn't even know who the chief politician is who controls the state. He's extremely naive. And Graham Greene writes in The Quiet American, his great novel about Vietnam, he said, innocence is a form of insanity. And I think about that a lot. And I began to think, yeah, Jimmy Stewart's character is kind of culpably innocent in that film. He's, you know, he doesn't belong in the Senate. He actually says that at one point. And some of the Coen brothers' characters, their goodness is a form of insanity in a way. So, I mean, these filmmakers are operating on very sophisticated levels that kind of float over the heads of a lot of film critics like Hoberman and other people who, like one thing, I was attacking Hoberman for saying in True Grit, there's a scene where a Native American gets hanged and he wants to say his last words, but they don't let him do it. They just press the thing and he goes down the chute, you know. And Hoberman was horribly offended by that. But, you know, they're making a point that the people in that film don't have any regard for this Native American character. And it's not the Coen brothers who are the racists. It's the society that they're satirizing. I mean, a lot of people don't get satire or irony or all these things that, you know, Jonathan Swift on down the line, A Modest Proposal. If he wrote that today, he'd probably be canceled, and people would say, horrible man, suggesting that Irish people should eat their children. They wouldn't get it. My favorite English teacher in high school was a Jesuit. He didn't become a priest. He went off and married a nun, but he was a scholastic, they called him. He said, never use irony because people won't get it. And he was correct in a sense. People usually don't get irony, but I love irony, and I use it all the time. But a lot of people just, you know, it floats over their heads. And the Coen brothers are so smart. I love their smartness, you know, and they're just way ahead of a lot of critics. But the audience, to give the audience their due, as Billy Wilder said, individual members of the audience can be idiots, but when they're all together, they're a genius. And they've done pretty well with audiences. Fargo is a big hit. True Grit is a big hit. I mean, I think that's a film that I was disappointed by, frankly, because I thought the original, I'm a big John Wayne fan, I thought he got his Oscar for making fun of himself, and I kind of regretted that. He should have won several Oscars for his great performances for Ford and Hawks, but here comes Jeff Bridges, one of my favorite actors, and I thought, well, okay, he'll recreate the role in some different way, but he did kind of a parody of John Wayne parodying John Wayne. you know, and I didn't think that worked very well. But the film is a beautiful film pictorially, and the young girl looks perfect for the part, but she can't handle the ornate dialogue with the Coen brothers. They write great dialogue. They're kind of like Preston Sturges. He's one of their great influences. But she just can't quite handle the dialogue. One point I was going to make, a lot of people ask the Coen brothers, who are your influences? And they expect them to spout, you know, filmmakers. But really, they say their influences are literary people. Raymond Chandler, who influences Big Lebowski, for example. Flannery O'Connor. I was reading her last short story recently, Revelation, which is, I think, might have inspired the last segment of Ballad of Buster Scruggs, which is my favorite Coen Brothers film, that very strange segment where all these people are crammed into a stagecoach and they're in the afterworld going into the afterlife. And the Revelation, dying Flannery O'Connor wrote a scene like that taking place in a dentist's office where all these people are crammed in and acting very strangely. And there was a religious old lady and a sacrilegious girl screaming at her. And it has a Coen Brothers tone. And they also love James M. Cain and Dashiell Hammett. You know, so those are their influences, those great literary figures.
You answered one of the questions I had, which is your favorite film. But why is it that one?
Well, I love Buster Scruggs. The Western is my favorite genre and always has been since I was a kid. And, you know, I grew up watching Westerns and I wrote two books on Ford. And, it didn't occur to me until after I'd done my Ford biography. Well, I come from a family of pioneer people. On my mother's side, they were Irish immigrants who came to Pennsylvania and they were coal miners. One of my great-grandfathers died in a coal mining accident. His wife and daughter took a wagon train west, and they stopped in Nebraska, which was considered west. It's Willacather country, but that's where Buster Scruggs' wagon train episode takes place, in Nebraska. And on the other side of the family, our family were pioneers also, and they, that was the McBride side of the family. They helped found a town in Nebraska, and they were robbed by the Jesse James gang. And I married an Irish woman, and her family, that was the one thing about our family history that they really thought was cool, that we were robbed by the Jesse James gang. They thought these people sound like mythical figures to Europeans, you know, but we were actually robbed by them. They were very nice to us. They had exhausted horses, and they demanded a swap of horses, and then they were very polite, and we gave them our horses, and they gave us their worn-out horses. If we had stuffed them, we'd be rich today. But on my mother's side, they were also Irish immigrants, and they wound up being silver miners in Idaho. And one of my great-grandmothers drove a stagecoach. I actually knew her. She died at age 96. She drove a stagecoach. So I come from a kind of Western family background, even though I grew up in a suburb of Milwaukee, Wisconsin, like the Coen brothers grew up in Minnesota. But anyway, Buster Scruggs is a six-part anthology of Coen brothers' greatest hits, in a sense. It's got all of their different modes of storytelling. It's got farce, black comedy, really devastating episode with this armless, legless thespian who's got a beautiful voice and he's treated like garbage in the West. And there's the raunchy, funny scene with the cowboy played by James Franco, who gets hanged. He turns to the guy next to him who's blubbering. He says, "First time, huh?" That's one of the signs of Coen Brothers films. But the most moving part is this 40-minute wagon train segment where about a young woman, Zoe Kazan is wonderful in the role. She goes west, very shy young woman, and it's very Fordian, pictorially, very beautiful sequence, but very dark. And it's based on a very obscure Western story. I don't know how the Coen brothers found these stories, but I dug them up. And there's also this great episode with Tom Waits based on a Jack London story about an old prospector. This is a really haunting tale. But when they were growing up, they read a lot, and I guess they read Jack London, and they read the guy who wrote the Gal Who Got Rattled is the name of the story that they've filmed with Zoe Kazan, and it's very moving about this young woman who gets terrified of Native Americans and kills herself precipitously, and she doesn't understand that she didn't have to do it. You know, and it's very moving. It's a beautiful romantic scene with this cowboy who loves her, and they're going to have a life together. And then in the next scene, she gets killed, and the old trail boss. It's very laconic dialogue, very beautiful dialogue, and it's a very sad episode, but very. That's the most realistic part of the film. Most of the Coen Brothers films are not terribly realistic, you know, but that that, and then it goes into the mode of this very fantastical, allegorical tale of the afterlife with disparate kind of people in a wagon. I mean, a stagecoach. Going into a hotel, which represents heaven, apparently, and we don't know what's going to happen at the end of the film. But it seems like a kind of film you make at the end of your career as a kind of summing up of your themes, of all the ways you make films, all the styles. And then it turned out the Coen brothers decided to take a break from each other for a while and not make films together, which I didn't expect. And actually, I should tell you, since you're interested, I did a book called Two Cheers for Hollywood, which is a collection of my short pieces. I've written many, many articles over the years, and I wanted to collect them. And this is 2017, I think. And I thought, well, you know, I've always wanted to write something on the Coen brothers, and I've never read something that, you know, I really felt captured them perfectly. There are some pretty good books on them, but I thought I'll write my piece on the Coen brothers. So I watched all their films again in a two-week period, deliberately out of order, because I didn't want to do it in a sequential order for some reason. I wanted to do a thematic approach. And I wrote a long critical monograph, which appeared in two Cheers for Hollywood. And I hope that it would get more attention. It didn't get a lot of attention, although the book has sold pretty well. So then I thought, well, you know, I should spin this off into a separate volume. And then they came out with Ballad of Buster Scruggs. And I thought, well, hey, I could add that together. And then Anthem Press contacted me, and they said, we're doing a bunch of short books on cinema. And I've always written these long, long books, you know, in recent years. When I was younger, I wrote shorter books. And when you get older, you see life in more facets and more complexity. But I've kind of, one of my secret goals has been to write a short book. So I finally thought, okay, they want a short book. I've got the perfect thing. I'll take my Coen Brothers monograph and I'll really tackle Buster Scruggs in depth, and I write a really good piece on it, and put it together as a short book with some really good frame enlargements, and that's what we did.
Well, great, and we're glad that you did. Well, we've taken up a lot of your time, for which we're very grateful. But before you go, I wonder, could you tell us about what you're working on now?
Well, I'm not sure right now. I'm kind of, you know, I had these four books out at once. I had the Billy Wilder book, Political Truth, about the assassination. And then I did an updated version of my book, Whatever Happened to Orson Welles, A Portrait of an Independent Career, and the Coen Brothers book. This, all four of them came out between October of last year and March of this year. It was quite a lot of things coming together, and it was more exhausting than I realized, because I had to, you know, read all the proofs and do all the final stages, you know, all the minutia that you have to do as an author. And then I started doing podcasts about these books. And my publicist at Columbia University Press says I must have set some kind of record for the number of podcasts in the last few months. I've been doing podcasts all the time. And they asked me to do podcasts on Wells a lot, and Capra and Kennedy. And, you know, that's one thing you learn. I didn't realize this when I started writing books on Wells and Ford, is that if you're going to write a book, you're going to have to spend your whole life following this subject, because you're going to have to do later editions and updated books and things. And, you know, a book is not just sort of finished and you can forget about it. I guess some authors think of it that way, but I like the Wells, I've done three books on him, and Whatever Happened to Orson Welles, that was a hard book to write. It took 5 years. I was really trying to cover his whole career, but majorly focusing on his last 15 years, which people didn't know much about, and how he got to be a totally independent filmmaker after having been a as my friend Douglas Comrie hypothesized and borrowed his theme. He was an independent filmmaker who briefly had the resources of major studios rather than being a failed Hollywood studio director. I followed that theme. But it took a lot of work to try to encompass Welles' career in 400 pages because, poor Simon Callow, who I admire, is on his fourth volume of Welles' biography. And he's been on it for 20 years, and I really wouldn't want to be doing that. Robert Caro, who I admire, he's done four volumes of his Lyndon Johnson biography, and he's in his 80s, and he's trying to finish it. You know, he's up to like 1968 or something like that. But I wanted to write a short book that was pithy and, you know, a good monograph on the Coens. And it was fun to do that. It was very exhilarating. And, you know, it influenced the writing of the Wilder book, even though the Wilder book came out later. I did a lot of the Coen book first, and I got bored with the usual approach of film studies books where they go film by film by film. And I thought, I'm really tired of that kind of book, and I want to do a book where you jump around thematically and just write whatever you think is a theme worth pursuing. And, you know, you can follow lines throughout somebody's whole body of work or whole career, you know, how they deal with religious issues, how they deal with comedy, how they deal with violence, etc. And I found that really exhilarating when I wrote the Coen Brothers monograph. And so I followed that approach with Wilder. The first half of the book is mostly chronological until he gets to be a director in Hollywood. And at that point, I warned the reader, I'm going to depart from chronology and I'm going to tackle him more thematically. And my editor, John Belton, and my other editor, Philip Leventhal, went along with that, and I'm grateful to them. And a few reviewers objected. They said it's, you know, hard to follow, but a lot of people thought this is kind of refreshing. You know, it's not the laborious, and then he made this, and then he made that kind of thing. I find it more fun and more intellectually lively to jump around in your head, you know, like I'm sure you do too. So that's what I've been doing with the Coen Brothers.
Right. There is a refreshing approach, particularly if, you know, the interesting thing about filmmakers is you go film by film by film. Well, one goes film by film, but what about the ones they didn't make? And they get left out. And that's often the gaps in between the projects that we know the least about. And you know, the films aren't necessarily the sum total of a director's output.
You know, I saw the exhibit in San Francisco, and I was really struck by the card file in Napoleon's life, where he had a card for every day in his life, or almost every day. But all that research was sort of funneled into Barry Lyndon, and you know, but there is the big Napoleon volume of his research and script, and that I do that with when I wrote biographies of directors, Capra, Ford, and Spielberg. You know, there'd be certain projects they tried to make that they couldn't make, fell through. But, you know, one reason I don't write biographies anymore is they're too expensive to write, I find. And I go broke every time I do a biography because I pour my own money into it. You never get a sufficient advance. And they don't sell as well as they should. Unfortunately, the public, I don't think, deeply cares about movie directors' lives. They care about politicians and they care about movie stars, etc. But I've never found a movie star whose life is interesting enough to write a book about. I thought of doing one with Spencer Tracy, but somebody else, James Curtis, did a good one on Tracy, who came from my hometown and went to my high school. But, you know, you put a lot of years into backbreaking work, and then the reward is not commensurate with the output. So I've gone back to writing critical studies, which is how I started, because I was in the Midwest. I didn't have access to filmmakers or archives very much. There was a good archive at our school, but I was writing more critical studies, and now I'm back to doing critical studies. I find that actually very refreshing and very liberating. You know, the Billy Wilder book and my book on Ernst Lubitsch, How Did Lubitsch Do It, that was a big critical study, and that took a lot of digging. One reason I wrote that was I just wanted to see all the Lubitsch films. A lot of them were hard to see in America. So I went to Europe several times and watched Lubitsch films and went, found his old apartment and where he grew up, and Max Reinhardt's theater and stuff. So it uses biographical tools, but to eliminate the work And somebody like Lubitsch, his films are more exciting than his life, you know. Whereas with Capra and Ford, they had very adventurous lives full of incident. And, you know, Ford went through World War II and the Korean War, et cetera. And Spielberg, you know, to research him, I had to research, I spent a year researching the Holocaust in great detail. And then I had to research sharks and dinosaurs and UFOs. It's interesting to get into the life of somebody like that. And when, as true, if you dig into Kubrick, you start delving into his obsessions too. But a critical study can be as illuminating as a biography if you do it right.
Yeah, indeed. And I look forward to, and we look forward to what your next one will be when you've decided what that is.
Yeah, I'm kind of mulling right now. I'm kind of, you know, just in the receptive mode, watching films and catching up on films and trying to figure out what I'd like to write about. It's kind of a nice feeling.
Do let us know when you've decided, and we look forward to reading that one. And there's a lot of reading to catch up on from you. But I'd like to thank you very much for being on the show today. Really enjoyed the chat.
Yeah, it's been great talking to you.